Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Chuck Blanke for his take on important recent developments in a variety of GI cancers. And to begin, he commented on a plenary presentation from the June ASCO meeting for which he was the discussant, a landmark trial comparing 1 to 3 years of adjuvant imatinib in GI stromal tumors.
And the imatinib treatment given for a longer period had a marked improvement in recurrence-free survival, which everybody on the planet expected. But what was really a surprise is it showed an overall survival benefit as well. You may recall from previous trials, like the North American Z9001 ACOSOG trial, there was a dramatic improvement in relapse-free survival with 1 year of therapy, but no overall survival benefit. And that led some oncologists not to use a drug because they figured they could catch up later in the metastatic setting. Couple of take-home points from the SSG18 1 versus 3 year study. Number one, I think 3 years is now the absolute gold standard if you're going to use adjuvant therapy. Number two, I think we no longer can wait and just give it to the people who relapse because of the overall survival benefit. I'm not actually sure it's real or it's going to hold up over time. And number three, we still don't actually know for sure if we're curing these patients or just prolonging their remission longer. And this has very important implications for whether 3 years really is the magic number, whether it's 5 years or 10 years, or in my opinion, if you should treat these patients lifelong, which is a huge commitment for an adjuvant patient who might already be cured.
What do you do right now when you have a patient who hits the 3 year point outside a protocol setting?
I keep them going if I can.
And, you know, another thing about this is sort of what does this mean biologically? And, you know, kind of when I think about cytostatic stuff, sometimes I think about like adjuvant endocrine therapy of breast cancer. But there you get a bump after you stop it for a while. One of the things that's amazing about the GIST thing, and I think you were the one who showed it, is if you take the curve, it's like as soon as you stop it, they start relapsing.
Yeah, it's between 6 and 12 months later, and it's like they fall off a cliff. And it doesn't matter if they've been treated for 1 year or for 3 years. The same thing happens. And that, I think, is additional evidence that we're merely prolonging remission and not curing the patients.
It's just, you know, I'm trying to think kind of almost biologically, you know, what would be a similar analogy in oncology right now? Anything that you could think of?
Well, you know, the discussant at the plenary session tried to look at things that were given for very long periods of time. And of course, you came up with one yourself, tamoxifen or an AI in breast cancer, but it's still curative. It's not just prolonging remission. Possibly something that could be analogous is the use of androgen suppression with irradiation in prostate cancer. We know if you do it for 3 years, it's better than 6 months, but there's also somewhat less robust data that if you do it lifelong, it works even better. Every other setting that I know of, like tamoxifen, is still somewhat time limited, probably between 5 and 10 years.
So anything else that has come out in GIST from a practical perspective?
Yes. Excellent question. The 2222 trial is one that I was part of, but it was the first North American and Finnish trial that was started about 10 years ago now that was just a phase 2 study of 400 versus 600 milligrams. Two interesting things. One, there was a 35% 9-year overall survival rate. So a third of the patients were alive and well almost a decade after starting. That's no big shocker. We know that these patients are doing well. But more importantly, after about 5 to 6 years, there were very few relapses. And so this has incredibly important implications for how we survey patients. For example, there is certainly no role for doing quarterly or even probably semi-annual CTs after maybe 5 or 6 years. So you can monitor your patients much less frequently, expose them to less radiation, less IV dye. And I think that was very important.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about your two cases as a way to kind of get into, you know, how does the current research translate into management of patients? Maybe we can begin with your 66-year-old woman.
Sure. This was a pretty healthy woman who basically was fatigued and had a bit of abdominal pain, was found to be anemic with a hemoglobin around 10. Instead of just running to the scope because she had some abdominal pain, they did do a CT and saw what they thought was a duodenal mass measuring about 2.6 centimeters. She ultimately went straight to the OR, no biopsy, and she clearly had a duodenal GIST that measured 3 centimeters with 6 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields.
What do you think about the idea of going right to surgery here without tissue?
I'm a big believer in tissue in general, but there's almost nothing this could be that doesn't need to come out. So when we strongly suspect GIST radiologically, we usually recommend a biopsy only if they're going to go on neoadjuvant treatment or a clinical trial.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you about, is neoadjuvant therapy and where we are with that. And are there situations where you'll do it off study?
I will certainly do it off study. Certainly if the patient's unresectable, it's a no-brainer. If it looks like they're going to have major organ toxicity as a result of surgery, and the classic example is a perirectal GIST that's going to need an APR, I will absolutely and unequivocally do it, but I always insist on tissue in those circumstances.
So can you talk about what was seen at surgery and pathologically?
Yeah, she obviously had a small bowel primary. There was no gross evidence of spread. And so she wound up having sort of a garden variety, KIT-expressing gastrointestinal stromal tumor. It was 3 centimeters in size, and there were 6 mitoses per 50 high-powered fields. I remember the case I was discussing with my resident because the pathologist didn't discuss the margins, which is commonly done, as you all know, with GI malignancies.
Didn't discuss the margins. So you had to go back and say what happened?
Well, normally, of course, that would be the knee-jerk correct thing to do. But you could actually raise the question in GIST if it makes any difference. There's actually some soft data from Memorial Sloan Kettering suggesting that if it's grossly resected, it doesn't matter if you have positive margins. That may be because it's always a systemic disease to begin with. But modern times, we do tend to look at the margins. If they're microscopically involved and it's an easy fix, we will send them back to surgery, but there's really no data proving that's the right thing to do. But I see that very commonly with gastric GISTs. More commonly, if it looks like we're sort of on the fence for imatinib adjuvant, yes or no, we do occasionally use the margins as a reason to tip us towards the imatinib.
So what was your estimate of her risk of recurrence?
So that's a great question. I think a basic question is, how do we actually look at it? In the old days, we had these broad descriptive categories that looked at various factors, including size, site of origin, the primary site, and mitotic rate. And again, we would just come up with an adjective, very low, low, high, et cetera. Now there are some nomograms that have been published in Lancet Oncology that let you plug in these factors, and you can actually come up with a 2- and 5-year relapse-free survival risk. In her case, because everything was bad, essentially, she only had a 20% chance of remaining free of disease at 2 years with surgery alone.
When you say everything was bad, can you be more specific?
I can. So the most powerful driver is mitotic rate. And patients that have 5 or more mitoses per 50 almost always get adjuvant therapy regardless. A small bowel primary has a much less ideal outlook than a gastric primary. And then size, it wasn't the worst. It wasn't one of these honking 10-centimeter GISTs, but it wasn't a microscopic GIST either. So she gets basically points that go into this nomogram for each of these, and then you come up with this numerical risk, which in her case is 80% chance of recurrence at 2 years.
And just in terms of quality control, I don't know if this has been studied, but it always comes up in oncology, you know, the information that you're getting. Is the issue about mitotic numbers per high-powered field and the other critical determinants here usually very easy to determine and the same between labs?
That is a fantastic question, and that is certainly the most ambiguous of the criteria. And where you're really in trouble is if they have, say, 4 to 6, so they're right around that greater than 5, because it can numerically change their chance of recurrence by 50% or more. And if it's really a decision you're making based on that one factor alone, I either get an expert pathologist like OHSU or Dana-Farber to look at it, or I err on the side of imatinib, to be honest.
So what were you thinking about in terms of treatment, both on and off study for her?
Sure. So off study, the standard therapy is clearly standard dose imatinib, 400 per day. She was actually seen right before the plenary presentation. So I told her we were going to start her. As of that day, I would anticipate at least a year of treatment, but I thought there was a pretty good chance we were going to recommend longer therapy. And again, she is somebody right now, if I could get away with it, I would treat her lifelong, but there's no clear data proving that to be the right thing to do. The right thing to do is at least 3 years of imatinib therapy. There is a trial that has just completed known as PERSIST-5, which was a phase 2 study that gave 5 years of therapy. And so obviously if the numbers look better at 5 years than they did at 3, it's an indirect comparison, but it would be additional data that longer is better.
And so she started treatment?
She did indeed start treatment with 400 per day.
And how's she doing?
She's doing fine, like most adjuvant patients do. They have mild side effects, but they usually tolerate it pretty well.
Now, are there trials in development right now, not just about the issue of duration, but the treatment itself in terms of improving outcome? And maybe actually from that point of view, you mentioned what you think her recurrence risk is without treatment. What did you tell her? Did the subject come up, I'm sure, of how that risk was going to be modified by treatment?
It does come up. The problem is, as we've already discussed, I couldn't tell her whether I was hoping to cure her with adjuvant therapy versus keep her in remission. So I did say there's, you know, roughly a 50-55% decrease in chance of recurrence, at least out to 3 to 5 years, but we don't really know what happens after that. I think a great question you just asked is a potential trial. She's a small bowel primary, which means her tumor has a very high chance of harboring an exon 9 mutation. Now you may say, well, who cares? But as you probably remember, exon 9 mutations are less sensitive clinically to imatinib. And so if she had this in the metastatic setting, she would get double dose drug. And the question is, do you need double dose drug in the adjuvant setting? So that is the current intergroup proposal. It's going to take exon 9 patients and randomize them between 800 and 400. It may not sound particularly exciting, but it's a question I get asked every single week by community oncologists, and we don't know the answer.
Absolutely. And do you know her results?
Not yet. It usually takes about 3 weeks to come back. I'm not sure, to be honest, I would do it off study. That's a little bit bolder of a move, and they can have side effects with the higher dose. So I probably, in most patients, would wait for a trial.
Is there any correlation between side effects and benefit when you're using imatinib and GIST?
No, at least not to my knowledge. Not the same way you'd think of with an EGFR antibody, for sure.
And then what other strategy? I mean, she still has a substantial risk of recurrence with this treatment. What other strategies are being looked at to improve the outcome?
Well, the problem is to have a new strategy, essentially what you need is a new drug. And as you well know, sunitinib is approved for GIST, but there is not a lot of enthusiasm to look at in the adjuvant setting because it's fairly toxic and the benefit is fairly marginal, even in advanced disease. So what we really need are newer late-line drugs that we can move back. If I could just add, one other thing came out of ASCO. Sorafenib, the drug that's obviously approved in HCC, has been floating around for a while in GIST. And there were two reports at ASCO that showed about a 70% tumor control rate with lack of progression for about 5 months. And this was very late-line therapy. So sorafenib obviously has been tested. There's regorafenib, which is a sort of a later derivative that is looking modestly promising as well. And it's possible that one of those drugs will eventually be moved up in combination, perhaps, or even by itself to the adjuvant setting.
What would you be thinking if this lady were unfortunate enough to develop disease progression while still receiving the adjuvant imatinib?
Well, GIST remains a difficult disease. The first thing you usually do is dose increase the imatinib if she weren't already on 800. Then it's usually a decision between going to sunitinib or, if it were a very isolated recurrence and she showed no other evidence of disease for a long time, you might consider surgical resection and continuing the imatinib. That's controversial. There have been some proposals for studies testing that concept as well, surgery versus continued imatinib.
Why don't we talk about your other patient, the 78-year-old woman?
Sure. So she, this may sound a little unusual, but I see this all the time. Again, it was an elderly woman with some abdominal pain, and she wound up having a CAT scan that suggested about a 4 cm gastroesophageal junction mass. They scoped her with an EGD, and she had a mass right there at the junction. It was a KIT-positive GIST. We staged her, nothing else showed up, and basically told her the standard of care is surgery, and she said, forget it, I'm almost 80 years old, I'm not going to have surgery.
And, you know, how did you feel about that? Would you think she probably would have tolerated surgery fine?
Yes, there's actually excellent data that patients who have good performance status, even if they're elderly, even in their advanced 80s, do tolerate upper GI surgery quite well. So I gently twisted her arm, but obviously I didn't push her too hard.
Why not?
Because I still believe in patient autonomy. That's a very reasonable question.
Yeah,
I encouraged it, but I don't think we can force our patients to do things they don't want to do.
Yeah. Well, what was her, had she had other surgeries? I mean, it just kind of seems a shame, you know, it's the next, I'm curious exactly how you'd approach her treatment, but it kind of seems like surgeries would be so much better than anything else.
Well, that's absolutely true. We have other options that we're going to talk about, but they're not expected to cure her. And as you well know, somebody who's that age with minimal comorbidities has a very long lifespan. The chance of her dying of GIST if she does anything but surgery is high. And so I did make that very clear to her that she would almost certainly die of GIST if she chooses not to undergo surgery.
Well, so I guess maybe you could envision a situation where you start treating her, you know, develop a relationship with her. Maybe she changes her mind. Anyhow, what happened?
I would think that would happen, except it's never happened. I've had about 5 of these so far. It makes
Wow.
perfect sense. They never change their mind.
Wow, interesting.
Anyway, so basically, obviously, the alternative is to give her imatinib. It's standard dosing. And what I could tell her is she has an extremely high chance of tumor control, but the progression-free survival average is 2 years. And so when she's 80, she's going to probably be in trouble. Now, there's a little bit of a caveat there. We just talked about that 2222 long-term trial. There's other data from the Southwest Oncology Group that does suggest maybe a quarter to a third of patients live indefinitely with tumor control. So I told her, you know, if she wins the lottery, she has a roughly 1 in 4 chance of staying on imatinib for the rest of her life and never needing surgery. And of course, that's what she's hoping for.
What is her lifestyle like and how functional is she?
Oh, incredibly functional. She cooks, she gardens. She wants to remain as active as possible for as long as possible.
Have you ever seen a situation like this, like in a 50 or 60-year-old?
Bizarrely, I did. I had a patient who had a gist at the other end. He had a perirectal gist. And not to besmirch him, he opted for vitamin therapy.
Wow.
Which I assured him was not likely to help him. He had a highly curable situation with surgery. To be honest, I didn't even mention imatinib as a possibility originally, but he absolutely refused. It became even more difficult. We put him on, well, we didn't. He put himself on vitamin therapy. He progressed. He came back in amazingly, hadn't metastasized, hadn't obstructed, wanted to stay on vitamin therapy in the face of pure evidence that he was progressing. And I still couldn't get him on imatinib. That one I did twist his arm as hard as I could. And I was unsuccessful for about another 8 months when he progressed again. And I finally got him to go on the drug and he responded.
And he did go to surgery?
He is still responding. And so he has not yet gone back. Now, of course, he doesn't want to go to surgery either. So he's going to be a tough sell because now he thinks he's going to be in that 25% that can just stay on imatinib forever. But it's not as reasonable for a 50-year-old in my mind.
Absolutely. So what happened with the 78-year-old lady?
Basically, this lady did go into remission on imatinib. She never progressed as of about 6 years later.
Wow.
And thus never underwent surgery.
And this was a complete remission?
Yes. Her disease completely disappeared. We can't even see it on CAT scan or endoscopy.
Any speculations or even better data on what differentiates a patient with a tumor like this from another patient who doesn't, you know, have a prolonged remission?
No, that's a stellar question. We know that a lot of long-term survivors do have exon 11 mutations, but not all of them. And that trial I told you about that had the 35% 9-year survival is assessing a number of factors, clinical and perhaps genetic, to see if we can predict who will be a long-term survivor. You could argue it doesn't matter because everybody gets the same treatment regardless, but it'd be nice to be able to tell patients.
So let's talk a little bit about colorectal cancer. And there were a couple issues I was curious, and maybe we can kind of tie it into ASCO where relevant. First, maybe we can just start out with your 62-year-old man.
Sure. He was a fairly classic, healthy guy. Again, became somewhat fatigued, went to see his primary care physician, had a COLT-positive stool, and he was found to be anemic with a hemoglobin just under 10. So he underwent endoscopy all the way complete and had a cecal mass that was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. He went to the OR after additional staging, showed nothing further, and he did indeed have a cecal primary. It was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. It was 5 centimeters. He had negative margins. He had 15 nodes examined, all of which were negative, and he had no other particular high-risk features for metastasis or recurrence.
So I'm curious about your discussion with him in terms of his risk of recurrence and whether that could be modified.
Yes. So I did indeed tell him that his risk of recurrence was fairly low. And as you well know, there are a number of different tools you can use to plug patients like this in and get another numerical chance of recurrence, but it was well under 50-50, obviously. The things that came up are, can we modify it? And the answer is theoretically yes. There's actually randomized data that giving patients chemotherapy can improve their outcome by a couple of percent, but the number needed to treat is so high, many of us opt not to treat unless the patient particularly pushes very hard for it. A number of other issues came up, including genetic testing. If we did decide to treat, what would we do in terms of choosing a drug, et cetera? Because he was curious, but he never actually went for it.
So did you actually get into the issue of, you know, actually trying to give a numeric estimate based on any of these models about what his actual, you said under 50%, that's a pretty wide range, what you thought his risk of recurrence was?
I came up with it myself, but I remember him quite well. He just wanted a ballpark figure, as a lot of these patients do.
So what was your ballpark figure and what was the one inside your head?
So the ballpark figure I had for him was he was certainly actually under probably 30% rather than under 50% for actual recurrence.
So under 30%, is that what was in your head, somewhere under 30?
Yes.
And, you know, 30 sounds kind of substantial, particularly if you have breast cancer and a lot of other things. How did you view his risk and options? You said you kind of feel like maybe there's a couple percent to benefit. How do you balance it out? And also, you know, one thing that is different between breast and colon is the availability of capecitabine, theoretically. I don't know if you ever use that in this situation.
Absolutely. No, you hit the nail on the head, which is I did not think his risk of recurrence was negligible. In other words, I thought he had a modestly substantial, if you will. The problem is you really can't modify that risk very much. I do think that, you know, treating 95, 98 patients to help two of them is a pretty large number. That said, as I talked about before, I'm a big believer in patient autonomy. If he said, I want therapy, I would have felt obligated to offer it to him. And as you pointed out, I don't actually think that oxaliplatin has a role in stage 2 patients who have standard risk features. I think we saw from Mosaic that standard risk stage 2 patients don't benefit. that would leave basically a fluoropyrimidine. Then you get into the whole issue of whether they're microsatellite unstable, because those patients might not even benefit from 5-FU. If he cleared that hurdle, which would be MSI testing, then I would absolutely and unequivocally offer him capecitabine for 6 months.
And again, thinking about the breast cancer analogy, where in many patients who are, quote, lower risk or node negative, now even some node positive, people are getting genomic assays, mainly the Oncotype DX in breast cancer, totally changed what happens. There is an Oncotype colon available. Actually, some people are ordering it right now. What do we know about it, and do you think there's a reason to use it?
I don't think it's wrong to use it. The problem with all the risk factor tests that have been done in colon cancer is they can discriminate a little bit more in terms of the risk of recurrence, but it's certainly not binary. It's not a yes, you should treat, no, you shouldn't treat. More importantly, in colon cancer, there's no proof that the people who are categorized as higher risk by the test benefit more from chemotherapy, if that makes sense. So it doesn't tell you whether really to even use it.
And that really ties into the theme that evolved in breast cancer of not so much predicting prognosis, but whether you benefit therapy. Where do you think things are heading in terms of trying to improve the outcome for patients like this, either using conventional therapies with better predictors or new therapies?
No, I think it's actually the former. I think because, again, we've had such lean times in colon cancer for new drugs, we had a whole plethora of drugs approved from about 1996 to 2005 or 2006. No new drugs have been approved since then. And really nothing has looked all that promising, to be very frank, in clinical testing. And so if you don't have a new drug, an alternate strategy is to better select a patient who needs the old drugs. And I think we are actually getting better at it slowly, and that's the direction we're likely to go.
You know, that seems to be the case. And sometimes I kind of wonder, is this biology or what's going on? Why is it, for example, in multiple myeloma, which occurs in 20,000 people a year, there's a huge proliferation of trials. Things are happening, it seems. And yet colon, you could maybe say the same thing about breast cancer, 10 times as common, not seeing too much. What's going on?
Well, did you have a chance to catch Dr. Sledge's presidential address at ASCO?
Totally. We've been talking about it all summer in many different tumor types. What was your take on it?
So just to summarize for your listeners, he divided cancers basically into smart cancers and stupid cancers. It was actually very elegant, much better than it sounds with me repeating his words. But the point was, stupid cancers are very simple. They usually have one genetic driver. And if you turn that driver off, the cells die. So GIST is a perfect example. CML is a great example. Lots and lots of drugs that hit the one target they have. On the other hand, he also talked about smart cancers like colon and pancreas and breast. And the problem is smart cancers tend to be the common ones, number one. Number two, they have a ton of redundancy in their genetic drivers. So you'd have to come up either with a number of different drugs that maybe all hit upstream targets. You have to find the common denominator downstream target. And it's very difficult to test because you might have 10 patients that would, in theory, need 10 different drugs. And you can imagine doing a clinical trial like that would be nearly impossible. We don't have the statistics to test 10 new drugs in one particular study. And so he actually suggested we would have to completely rethink how we approach clinical trials. And I agree with that. And anyway, I think colon cancer is a smart cancer.
So let's talk about your 47-year-old.
Sure. This was actually a 47-year-old male, of course, completely healthy. He presented with just the mildest abdominal pain, but it was very, very persistent. Unlike my other patients, was not particularly anemic, but he wound up having a CAT scan that showed a mid-transverse colon mass. He had a single 4-centimeter hepatic mass, and he underwent lower endoscopy that showed a transverse colon mass that was a moderately differentiated adenocarcinoma. Interestingly, his abdominal pain went away after the endoscopy, as often happens for reasons we don't understand.
So did you view him as having a asymptomatic primary, a mildly symptomatic primary, or a symptomatic primary?
That's why I made the statement. By the time we worked it up, I think the pain was a red herring that allowed us to diagnose this. I viewed him as having an asymptomatic primary, and that is a critically important question.
And what do we know about that, and how do you think through this kind of a situation today compared to 3-4 years ago?
Well, so the single most important question that we always have to ask ourselves with any patient with colon cancer is this patient curable with any modality or combination of treatments? You don't want to overlook a potentially curable patient, even if you have the hottest new drug available, and just automatically give it without thinking about cure. This patient clearly is curable. So the question is, what is the best way to achieve cure? Do we need to temporize while we're waiting? And there's some associated questions like, are we sure, for example, that what's in his liver is colon cancer, and do we have to biopsy it?
So what did you actually do?
So in his case, because he had synchronous disease, even though he was technically surgically resectable at the very beginning, our enthusiasm for taking him to the OR was a little bit lower than it might have been. You probably could have made the argument, since I'm going to give him systemic therapy, if the liver met shrunk dramatically, it's probably cancer. But because he was so young, I just wanted to make sure we weren't missing something else. So I did do a liver biopsy, FNA, and he did indeed have adenocarcinoma there. We put him on what we consider to be best systemic therapy while watching him quite closely. We did not do treatment for the primary, meaning I did not take him to the OR first. And I think that that is an okay strategy if the primary is asymptomatic. It is not an okay strategy if the primary is symptomatic. And he basically responded both cases and then went for sequential surgery.
What about the option of just going ahead with surgery on both the hepatic and primary up front?
If it's technically feasible, I don't think it's the wrong thing to do. It's just a matter of the prognosis is worse the shorter the disease-free interval is. And of course, his disease-free interval was zero. And the last thing I wanted to do was do a major whack on him, image him in 6 weeks, and he's got 20 liver mets. I wanted at least one more test of time. And to be honest, the systemic therapy was as much for that purpose as to control his disease.
There was some data presented at ASCO, and I'm curious, it's kind of a practical question. Did you do a PET scan on him looking for other disease?
I didn't do it when he first presented because it didn't change my management. I did do it before his resection because it can change your surgical approach.
Am I correct in saying that at ASCO there were data presented suggesting that maybe PET scans shouldn't be done?
Yes. Basically, the data suggested that we might be overusing PET or overemphasizing its ability to detect situations that would change. You're right. That said, I think PET scans still have a clear role.
Well, that's also looking at a whole bunch of patients. I mean, if you had patients yourself, my understanding is the idea of a PET scan in this situation is look for other disease.
Exactly.
And have you had patients where that's happened?
Absolutely. I think across the board, you can still argue there's somewhere between a 20-25% chance of finding disease you did not expect.
But yet in this study, they didn't see that.
No, and I think there are a lot of potential reasons. That said, I wouldn't take that particular trial as being definitive.
So I'm curious, if this man had presented initially with a colon tumor and then, you know, a couple years later with this lesion in the liver, how would you have thought it through?
That's a brilliant question. I would have taken him right to the OR and whacked it out. Then we would have been faced with the difficult question, what do you do afterward?
Well, there's also the question of whether or not you, quote, taking him to the OR right away and whack it out, because there is the thinking, particularly seems to be more maybe in Europe, I don't know, about using pre-op systemic therapy.
It's true, but again, if they have a solitary met, you're betting they're surgically curable. Maybe it's true that chemotherapy will increase the odds of cure, but there's no real proof it has to be done pre-op versus post-op.
So getting back to this patient, you said you gave him systemic therapy with the primary in place. What exactly was the systemic therapy and what exactly happened?
So I gave him what I consider to be the best metastatic therapy, which is FOLFOX with bevacizumab. That's very controversial nowadays, especially the use of biologics. And a lot of my compatriots are not using any biologics when people have systemic metastases that are going to go to the OR. The other difficulty is, especially if you use a different one, say cetuximab or even Bev, or you use irinotecan, what do you do postoperatively? You may recall that stage 3 patients have no benefit from irinotecan, bevacizumab, or cetuximab. The State of the Science NCI meeting just said stage 4, no evidence of disease patients are biologically the same as stage 3. And you could thus make the argument postoperatively in a hepatic MET patient not to use irinotecan, Bev, or cetuximab, and none of us knows the right answer.
Now, even though you were moving forward with FOLFOX bevacizumab, did you get a KRAS and what did it show?
I did not get a KRAS. I admit I'm in the minority because a lot of my colleagues get it right off the bat. I wait and see if they're going to be getting later line therapy. Nowadays, it's very easy to get quickly. It doesn't really change things, and so I don't get one right away.
So how many cycles of treatment did you give him before he went to the OR? What exactly happened? When did you stop the Bev?
So that's a great question as well, which is if you're going to use neoadjuvant therapy, what's the endpoint? You can do it for a set period of time. You can do it till max response. Those are basically the two biggest options. In his case, he had dramatic shrinkage over the first 3 cycles, and then he slowed up. So he wound up going to surgery roughly 2.5 months later. I do like to have them off the Bev for about a month beforehand just for safety. And so I kept the FOLFOX going until about 1 cycle before OR, and then I stopped that drug as well. Postoperatively, I gave him more FOLFOX, but I did not use the Bev for the reasons we talked about before.
And how did he do in terms of the surgery?
He did great. He sailed through it like a 47-year-old should. And let's see, I'm trying to remember when I saw him. He's probably out now about 1.5 years later with no evidence of recurrent disease.
What about this issue of neoadjuvant therapy? Am I correct in saying the NSABP, and I'm not sure if the RTOG is involved with this, is actually doing a study looking at that?
There actually have been a number of different trials through a bunch of the different North American cooperative groups, but they really haven't asked, in my opinion, necessarily the right questions, and or we don't have enough new agents to really make a difference. What I'd kind of like to see myself would be a standard pre-op versus post-op trial for the reasons we talked about, maybe testing some of the newer agents that don't have a role in stage 3 disease.
Any comments on the VEGF trap aflibercept that was reported to have activity in the second-line metastatic colorectal cancer setting?
Basically, if you look at angiogenesis, there are a number of different potential targets. You can target the VEGF ligand itself. You can target the receptor with small molecules. You can have decoy ligand or receptors, and that's basically how the VEGF trap works. But in my mind, they all have the same ultimate mechanism, which of course we don't actually understand all that well, which might be either impeding tumor blood vessels, or if you really think about it, they could increase flow of chemotherapy or whatever systemic agent you're using. In my mind, I think it's no surprise that the VEGF trap study is positive. ECOG 3200 was a second-line trial done by the cooperative groups in North America of bevacizumab. It was highly positive. To be honest, I would expect almost any of the agents to probably have about the same level of efficacy, so it's no shocker. The small molecules may be an exception. We still don't know how well they work.
So we were talking about KRAS, and I'm curious about your take on the presentation at ASCO looking at KRAS G13D mutations.
Yeah, I actually think this was one of the most interesting GI presentations. Basically, her group took patients that were included in a full FOX cetuximab trial and a full FURI cetuximab trial, and they looked at a variety of KRAS mutations. The reason they did that is G13D is a modestly common mutation that seems to perhaps preclinically still be sensitive to EGFR antibody therapy. And so they showed a couple of things. Number one, if you have this mutation, you prognostically do worse than patients who do not have it. So again, it's a clear prognosticator of how you're going to do. She presented some relatively soft, because there was a lack of power data, suggesting almost all parameters were still improved with cetuximab plus chemo versus chemo alone if you had a G13D mutation. In other words, it doesn't predict for absolute insensitivity to cetuximab or even panitumumab by extension, according to these study results. And I think the discussant basically backed that up. My problem was it still wasn't statistically significant, if you will. And while I believe it is probably true, I think it's a huge leap of faith. It comes up now because there's still an ongoing North American trial that prohibits KRAS mutant patients. And there is some discussion of whether or not G13D patients should be allowed. I also get a lot of questions from the community about whether or not we should be treating those patients.
So when we order, quote, a typical KRAS mutation test, what's it actually evaluating?
Obviously, it depends on which one you have done. But in general, they look at a variety of exon 12 and exon 13 mutations. And so you might very well get back a report that you have only a G13D mutation, and then you're in a bit of a pickle.
So just so I understand this better, so normally an oncologist, somebody orders, quote, KRAS testing.
Exactly.
And typically then they will identify the exact mutation?
Yes. But you don't really care until this presentation. You would say, ah, mutation present, don't use cetuximab. Mutation not present, it's an option. And so this is going to be a big paradigm changer if people accept it.
And what fraction of people who have, quote, KRAS mutations have this G13D?
So on this trial, it was 8%.
8%.
I mean, it's not insignificant. It's not the overwhelming majority or even the majority by that extension, but it's a lot. Often enough that you'd need to know. If it's real, that is. You seem skeptical.
No, I'm just trying to understand it, to be honest with you. You know, where is the KRAS pathway that these mutations are occurring in, and how does it tie into the function of the cell, as well as the theoretical reason why it would have something to do with EGFR antibodies?
Well, so it's downstream of the receptor, but it's relatively upstream from the nuclear pathways that guide proliferation, survival, invasiveness. And it makes sense that it could control the ability of the cell to respond to an EGFR inhibitor or not. So the options, if you do have the mutation, are to think about a downstream inhibitor or to try and do another pathway that would do an end run around it.
Anything else that happened at ASCO as it relates to colorectal cancer you want to comment on?
I should comment that last year at ASCO, your listeners may recall that oxaliplatin in rectal cancer was questioned because it didn't seem to improve local control, if you will. In other words, it didn't act as a radiosensitizer. There were more trials looking at it this year. This time we had the R04 cooperative group trial that basically, again, didn't suggest a real benefit for oxaliplatin on local factors, surgical outcomes, if you will. It did suggest, however, that capecitabine is as good as fluoropyrimidines by an IV route, so that was important. There was a German trial that in an unplanned analysis showed a 4% improvement in pathologic CR rate with oxaliplatin, but we don't know the long-term benefit. My take-home message is I wouldn't use oxaliplatin during the radiation myself until we have more data. I think if you have a node-positive patient, for the adjuvant component, postoperatively, it is still biologically sensible to offer oxaliplatin.
That R04 study, the NSABP study, is much awaited, although you wait so long for these studies, by the time they happen, you maybe are not as interested. But from a practical perspective, it did have this huge issue about capecitabine versus 5-FU. At this point, do you see a rationale for using neoadjuvant 5-FU with radiation therapy?
No, not really.
I mean, my take is at least up until ASCO, there was not a small amount of 5-FU being used in practice.
You know, it's funny. Certainly, I think the community embraced capecitabine much earlier than the academic centers, and they've been doing it for a while. Most of my colleagues in academia have declined to do so, but I think now we'll be forced to, if you will.
What about neuroendocrine tumors? You want to comment on that?
Yeah, so neuroendocrine tumors, in some ways, are the new gist in my mind. They've undergone a lot of discussion in terms of their classification. And the discussant at ASCO this year said a good way to think about them are the pancreatic neuroendocrines and the so-called WD-NETs, the well-differentiated neuroendocrines, which used to be called carcinoids. Now, again, we're talking about overall pretty well-differentiated tumors. We're not talking about the high-grade small cells or the adenocarcinomas with neuroendocrine features. We're talking about either pancreatic or what we would have called carcinoids. And the bottom line is there seems to certainly be an emerging role for the biologics. So everolimus and sunitinib have clear roles late line in the pancreatics as of right now. Everolimus has a suggested role in what we would have called carcinoid or the WD-NETs in terms of tumor control, but the discussant felt it needs more corroboration. I tend to agree with that. There was also a hint that it might be useful in patients with carcinoid symptoms. And I think the data is reasonable for that as well, but I think more time is important.
What else happened at ASCO and it's come out recently in GI cancers that you want to comment on? And maybe I could shift a little bit towards pancreatic cancer as well as gastroesophageal cancer.
Yeah, sorry. Do you want to talk about any negative trials or only positive?
No, we can talk about negative trials. I think that's important.
Okay. So I'll just tell you something before. There was nothing in pancreas, literally nothing. It was just the worst year ever. There are a couple of interesting things in upper GI. There was a long-awaited adjuvant trial in gastric cancer. You may recall that intensifying therapy in the metastatic setting might be better, particularly adding an anthracycline. So there's this ECF regimen that has some popularity in North America and certainly overseas. And so the CLGB did an adjuvant trial where they still used 5-FU during their radiation, but then intensified systemically with ECF. Took the trial about 6 years to accrue. It was really slow going, and it was stone cold negative. There wasn't a hint of benefit. So 5-FU remains the standard with the radiation in North America. Now, it gets a little bit more interesting. There was a CAPOX, capecitabine oxaliplatin trial, that looked at no radiation therapy and showed a dramatic improvement in progression-free survival. No improvement yet in overall survival, but they thought that might occur with more time. There was maybe a tiny trend with a p-value of 0.08. But the difference is North American patients don't get the same level of surgery that Asians do. They don't usually get D2 resections, which include tail of the pancreas and splenic nodes. And so most experts still feel that North American patients need irradiation and won't use chemotherapy alone, even though we have plenty of data from UK and Asia that it's reasonable in some populations.
What about the issue of HER2-positive gastric cancer and anti-HER2 therapy? I didn't see much at ASCO in terms of treatment, but there was some stuff looking at sort of the incidence of HER2 positivity. How do you kind of put that together at this point?
You know, it's funny because, and this I'm speaking purely experientially because we've been designing some new trials and keeping track, we are not able to confirm a 20% incidence of HER2-positive gastric cancer at any of the academic centers. That said, the data I saw at ASCO suggested that really is the right number. But I just don't know if it's a referral phenomenon or what's going on, but I remain skeptical. There was some data for some of the newer lapatinib-like drugs and newer generations multi-HER agents that did show some vague activity, and that's probably an area worth watching in gastric cancer specifically.
Do you consider HER2 testing right now standard?
Absolutely. I think they mandate trastuzumab.
And how long do you continue it?
Oh, that's a tougher question. Since we're usually in the metastatic setting, I certainly do it until they progress. And then you have the whole sort of her beyond progression that you might see in breast cancer, but there's little enthusiasm that I know of for doing it in gastric cancer right now. However, it might actually be the right thing to do.
What about hepatocellular cancer? Anything that's been presented or discussed at ASCO?
Well, there are two very interesting papers. One of them was a sorafenib versus sunitinib trial. And you might say, well, who really cares? But there's some pretty good theoretical rationale for using sunitinib. But the bottom line is it was an absolute unbelievable loser versus sorafenib. So there's just no role whatsoever for that drug. I won't go into the reasons unless you particularly want me to. But it's more toxic and less beneficial, and there's no reason to use it. There was a non-intervention trial known as Gideon that looked at, well, for one thing, it was the largest trial ever conducted in HCC prospectively. And they had a pretty fair collection of Child's Pew B patients. Now, you may recall that the SHARP trial and all the other standard trials that have tested sorafenib have looked at the healthiest of the healthy and looked only at Child's Pew A patients. The bottom line is it was a pretty confusing study, but the author clearly felt that you can give Child's Pew B patients sorafenib at full dose. The discussant said if you're going to pick the B patients, maybe, you know, the B plus, if you will, you can start at full dose. But he stopped short of saying that it's absolutely okay to give Child's Pew B patients sorafenib.
What do you do yourself?
I will not do it. I think the data does not support it at this point.
You know, that Gideon, I guess it's actually a registry in a way.
It is written in a way, exactly.
Prospective right. Registry. Alan Vanook had presented some data at the GI symposium on that and looking more at, I think, the way the patients were managed, whether they were taken care of by an oncologist or hepatologist, which kind of surprised me. I didn't realize so many hepatologists were using sorafenib.
Oh, yeah.
What's your take on that question in terms of sort of the difference between how people approach the disease?
It's ironic because the hepatologists invariably want to treat everybody systemically. In fact, they were pushing me to use sorafenib adjuvantly long before the trial started.
Interesting. And that's what you're seeing sort of locally yourself?
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe you can comment on the paper that was presented on anal cancer at ASCO.
Yeah, so unfortunately, there's some more negativity. RTOG 9811 was a very interesting trial that looked at good old-fashioned mitomycin-based chemo-RT versus cisplatin, which obviously is theoretically more attractive. When the trial was originally presented, there was a decrement with cisplatin on sort of local control factors. The problem is with further analysis, there is now a disease-free and overall survival benefit with mitomycin, the old-fashioned chemo. So the reason I bring it up is I think mitomycin remains the absolute standard, and there is no reason to use cisplatin unless they have an allergy to mitomycin in the year 2011.